You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today to talk about the events of 11 months ago is Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. Jordan, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. It's semester's over. Got a little bit of adjuncting work I'm wrapping up here and there, but by and large, it's Miller time.
Yeah, I have not looked forward to Christmas break quite this much in a long time.
Oh yeah, I mean, like all academics, I spend my Christmas break kind of lounging around, you know, doing really nothing, watching TV, that sort of thing. Speaking of lounging around watching TV, also on the line with us, we have Nathan Gilmore, professor of English at Emmanuel College in Franklin Springs, Georgia. Nathan, how you doing?
I am doing pretty well. Because of Emmanuel's weird schedule, I've actually wrapped up two semesters here in the last month. Fall semester ended just before Thanksgiving, and winter semester wrapped up on Wednesday. So I'm finishing up the grading and getting that in before we take off to see family up north starting Monday.
And what does up north mean from where you're at?
In the suburbs of Indianapolis, and then Mary's brothers live in West Pennsylvania, and her parents live in the East Panhandle of West Virginia.
All right, nice little trip around the Upper Midwest there, or what would that be? The Western East? I'm not sure. The Rust Belt.
It's 3,000 miles on the minivan. That's how I think of it.
Well, we should get into the topic for today. So today we're going to be talking about an article that came out in the Atlantic last week. So December 6th, 2021. I think this was in the print version and online. This was an article called "Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun" by Barton Gilman. The subtitle being "January 6th was practice. Donald Trump's GOP is much better positioned to subvert the next election." This came across my newsfeed and I read it and it was super irritating. So I tried to find other people who would also be irritated. Jordan and Nathan both jumped on the show. Let's just start with a quick overview of it, if a quick overview is possible. I mean, this article is like 20 pages long. Nathan, can you give us like a short form summary? And I'm picking on you because you're the one who posted show notes for the episode.
Yeah, I can try to do that. So first of all, you know, what this article posits is that the riot of January 6th, or the insurgency of January 6th, or the attempted coup of January 6th, or the guided tour gone wrong of January 6th, and we'll talk a little bit about what those vocabularies all carry with them, is not an isolated event, that it was a sort of late stage, last ditch effort to take by force what the conspirators in this story, and I say conspirators because, I mean, it is really narrated as a very willful and a very orchestrated plan that crosses the nation, that crosses several agencies, so on and so forth. But January 6th was kind of a last-ditch effort. Now, the article goes on to say that, you know, whatever they were trying to accomplish on January 6th, and I'm a little bit later as well, it did succeed. However, it shows that such things are possible, that the overthrow of the government is possible, that the end of American democracy is possible. And therefore, those people who are Democrats, both the political faction and those dedicated to a system of government called democracy, should be taking this seriously. However, they are not. They are proceeding as if things are going according to normal, even as Donald Trump and the allies of Donald Trump continue to plot to overthrow things on November, and I actually don't know what election day will be in November 2024, but in early November 2024. And so, you know, this is a combination of a descriptive task where, you know, Joe Stevens is, you know, trying to connect dots, if you will, between a number of phenomena that have been in the news, and then also, you know, a call to action to take seriously this threat to democracy. Now, one of the things that I wasn't really clear on by the end of the article is, you know, what he meant by take it seriously. You know, does he mean, you know, send the FBI to round up GOP senators? Does he mean, you know, have federal troops, presumably National Guard, although, you know, he's not clear on that either, at polling places to make sure that bad guys don't steal ballots? He's not really clear on that. But, you know, what does run all the way through this piece is a sense that, you know, what happened on January 6th is, you know, I mean, to paraphrase, you know, Joe Biden, among others, the biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War, and that, you know, whatever it means to take it seriously, people should start taking seriously. So, Jordan, I mean, you know, as far as the broad brushstrokes before we get into discussing particular questions, are there any sections of the article, big questions that I kind of left untreated there?
I don't think so. I think that does a really admirable job of condensing his primary concerns. And I say admirable job because it's a very sprawling, ranty, diffuse kind of article. It's kind of a grab bag of everything somebody of this particular author's ilk would probably have been upset about over the last 5 or 6 years. I actually had a very difficult time tracking with it when I was reading it the first time, just because it seemed to bounce around from January 6th to, you know, changes in the state legislature in the state of Georgia, to voting laws, to the apparent or purported detachment from reality of the average Trump voter, however you construe the average Trump voter. It just jumps around a whole lot. So, I mean, that's if you're going to find a through line, I think you just nailed it.
Yeah, I think that's that is certainly the thread that ties the whole thing together. And I like your connecting the dots analogy, because when I was reading this, I was totally imagining like the stereotypical conspiracy wallboard with pen stuck in the wall and like yarn tied from Steve Bannon's podcast to the January 6th insurrection to Donald Trump's speech to these reforms that are going on in the various states or law changes or whatever. I'm not up on all of the legal changes that have happened with regard to elections in the states, but they're definitely on this board too. I don't know that I'd go quite so far as to say it's a work of conspiracy, but I think you see some of the elements at work there. And I say it's not quite a full bore conspiracy, because I don't know that there's anything he says in the article that's not true. If that makes sense, it's more the lines that he's drawing that's where I start to say, well, wait a second.
Well, and I guess for me, I mean, that's kind of what the substance of a conspiracy theory is. It takes things that are real in the world and draws connections to them that imply a coordinated agency that most people find difficult to believe.
Yeah, I think and maybe I'm just thinking too much in contrast here with the other side of this argument, which is that Donald Trump actually won the election, right? Which there, I think you have an argument that is disconnected from reality, that argues that Donald Trump, in fact, did not lose this election. He did get more votes in these swing states, even though they were super close in the previous election. And then the conspiracy builds from that first foundational premise. Obviously, that's not all conspiracies. I may just be taking this one and using it too much as a point of comparison.
I think that's fair enough.
Jordan, did you have anything to add on conspiracy? Otherwise, I don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole when you and Danny have already gone there on Sectarian Review.
Yeah, let me. Oh, that's been years and years. That was the spring of 2016, actually. Yeah, if I can refer the listener back to, I think the very second podcast I ever did was with Danny, and we just kind of had like a very lengthy conversation about conspiracism writ large, and get into the different kinds of conspiracy theories. And I mean, I think yeah, there's many different kinds, and I think y'all have outlined two, where there's conspiracy theories that are built on, you know, building castles in the clouds that are just, you know, basically fantasy. And then there are the kinds that I would have to, you know, side with Nathan here on this, that what you've got here is certainly conspiratorial, certainly conspiracist in tone. I don't want to come back to that in a minute. But yeah, I mean, it's like Coyle said, nothing he said is outright false, but the way everything is construed, the way everything is, for lack of a better word, spun, puts it into the, you know, everybody involved is somehow, you know, kind of omnicompetent. Everything is working out, you know, everything is, you know, played out three or four chess moves ahead of time. And, you know, there's coordination, there's some kind of central planning going on where, you know, the, like I said, the various legislative state changes in a whole bunch of different states to do this and that and blah, blah, blah. What is most striking about it, though, is absolutely the, you know, if you read a lot of conspiracy stuff, it's the tone, you know, it's that kind of fevered, sometimes desperate moral urgency, which just kind of drips out of every sentence of this essay, that in combination with, again, that kind of corkboard and red yarn kind of attitude of, I mean, just, I think Nathan had a question in his reading notes, you know, something to the effect of like, does this guy know how he sounds? And that was one of my overriding thoughts, especially as he was going on at length about the, you know, the conspiracy theories animating the Trumpites or whatever. I said, you know, at some point in the essay, I realized he sounds exactly as paranoid as any of the people he's critiquing. So, I mean, it, you know, we can dither about facts, but yeah, tonally, this is definitely a piece of conspiracist literature, I would say.
Yeah, I almost sent you guys a copy of, so Hillsdale College has a, I think it's a monthly newsletter where they bring in a big name speaker, and then they publish the speech and send it out to all of, you know, whoever wants to hear it. And their September version of that was titled The January 6th Insurrection Hoax. And it is just the mirror image of everything in this article. Kind of the Trumpian mirror image of it, going through how it really wasn't an insurrection, and it really wasn't, which as far as that goes, I mean, the technical definition, okay, fine, whatever, riot, right? You know, whatever you want to call it. But really these were a bunch of patriots, and the election was stolen. And I mean, it is, you guys owe me for not making you read this for this episode is what I'm saying here.
Who is the speaker behind that?
Roger Kimball, the editor of New Criterion. Yeah.
The thing that popped into my mind after having read this Atlantic piece was that it was published pseudonymously, but it turned out to be Michael Anton, that Flight 93 election piece.
Yeah.
From, what is it, 2015, 2016. Just, again, the fevered tone and the moral urgency, which even where you're laying out factually correct things, the wild-eyed street preacher and a sandwich sign kind of attitude puts it into that realm.
Yeah, well, and I don't know how far down the conspiracy rabbit trail we should go, but part of what makes this difficult is because both conspiratorial views are dealing with things that are true. So from the perspective of this article, Biden did win the election. From the perspective of conservatives, the left is pushing a social, political, economic, whatever agenda that they see as destructive to themselves and the nation. I guess I should say ourselves and the nation as a conservative. That doesn't mean that all of the conspiracy theories are right, and that, you know, it's really a secret cabal of, you know, Epstein and his pedophiles or whatever it is that the right is pushing these days.
Right. Running out of a pizza parlor and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean all of that's true. But they are dealing with things that aren't true.
Right, right. And, you know, just to run with that a little bit, I mean, you know, one of the things that I think separates, you know, the flavors, if you will, of conspiracy, and I am going to use conspiracy because I really do think that, I mean, both of them assume a coordination that I just don't see happening. But I think that, you know, one of the things that distinguishes the two kinds of conspiracy thinking is that whereas, you know, the right-wing versions of the conspiracy posit a kind of mastermind character to, you know, the cultural, social, and ultimately political takeover, you know, what characterizes the narratives that I hear coming from writers like Joe Stevens is this idea of desperation, right? So, I mean, you know, it's not that, you know, they are in control and pulling strings and making things happen so much as they have a sense that they are losing control and therefore they are willing to do very, very dangerous things in order to retain that control that they think that they should have. And therefore, I mean, you know, what you get, I think, and, you know, I mean, I've listeners, if you're writing your emails about, you know, how I'm engaging in both sidesism, just keep writing because I'm going to keep doing it here. But, you know, what you end up getting, I think, is a reduction of complexity. So in other words, I mean, you know, there's not a sense that, okay, these are people with complex human motives, but I mean, you know, these are threats and, you know, therefore the only thing to do is to take immediate and dramatic action rather than to slow down and try to understand. And in fact, if you do try to understand with any kind of complexity, you know, you are characterized, and I think Joe Stevens does this in this piece, as someone who is not taking it seriously.
Right. And I think, yeah, like you said, that's kind of on both sides, right? Both sides are approaching the point where if you ask them the question, is violence okay, with respect to whatever issue it is that they think is critical, immediately critical, the answer is yes. And that, it's not that we've never been there before in society. We've certainly had violence on occasion in our past, but it's a point that's not terribly healthy.
No.
Right. And I mean, you know, just to illustrate what Coyle just said, I mean, you know, the recent, you know, Pew survey, you know, had, you know, somewhere upwards of, I think, 30% of self-identified, you know, white evangelicals saying that, you know, the time might be near where, you know, patriots have to use violence in order to secure the American Constitution. And then on the other hand, you know, I mean, I haven't seen polling data, but I mean, you know, as far as, you know, the loudest and the shrillest voices, you get things, you know, like the trending hashtag punch Nazis, right? To where, I mean, you know, the idea is that the only real answer to certain kinds of speech, certain kinds of ideas is to, and I hate this neologism, so understand, listeners, that I'm actually dragging my fingernails down a chalkboard as I'm saying it, but to deplatform them and make sure that no one can hear them, because the very act of speaking is something that poses a danger. And, you know, I mean, I'm a terrible poker player. So, I mean, you can hear that I don't think much of that position on things, but, you know, they're not identical. And I always want to be careful not to posit things as identical when they're not, but they're certainly related phenomena.
And like, I mean, whether it's deplatforming or responding to certain ideas just with violence, both of those are like conspiracy theories simplifications.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, you know, they really can't, they don't have the resources to deal with their own implications. Right. So, I mean, you know, I mean the, and you know, I, and it's funny because I mean, I've got people who I respect greatly and love dearly who say things like this, you know, that, you know, you can't allow Nazis to have a public platform because, you know, I mean, the very ideas can't be countered by more speech. They have to be, you know, shut down by other means. And, you know, I mean, when you pose the very simple question, you know, does that mean that whoever wins the next election gets to decide whose speech gets shut down as dangerous? Well, then they say, well, no, I mean, you know, it's got to be the stuff that is objectively dangerous. And I'm like, well, good luck with that.
Right. Only if my side wins do we get to say that we're banning certain kinds of speech.
Right, exactly. Well, guys, now that my microphone's working, and listeners, I mean, I'm sure Coyle's going to do some editing magic here, but I was working on a computer that my kids use, which if you're starting up a podcast, listeners, don't ever use a computer that your kids use, especially if they're teenagers. One of the questions that I have for you guys is, I mean, one of the features of this article that's not unique to this article, but this strikes me as an occasion to ask people whose views I like to hear about this, because I've kind of been thinking about it as I've driven here and there and listened to different, you know, podcasts mainly use different verbs for this. But I mean, this article pretty consistently calls what happened on January 6th an insurrection. I have heard other people refer to it as an attempted coup. I've heard, you know, some especially, well, no. I need to stay descriptive for a moment. I'll get evaluative soon enough. I've heard other people refer to it, you know, as a protest, you know, where just a few bad apples happen to stray. You know, I tend to think of it as a riot because, you know, I mean, it's a public demonstration that ended in violence, which in my mind is kind of, you know, the working definition of a riot. Was it an insurrection or was it something else on January 6th? Jordan?
I would go with riot for exactly the same reasons you just laid out. I mean, I know a couple of people who were actually up there for that day. They didn't go into the Capitol, so they're still at large. But, I mean, they went there for a demonstration. And, you know, the storming of the Capitol and everything was really clearly not on their agenda. You know, just speaking anecdotally of the one or two people I know who were there. But also,
right.
I mean,
storming, that's one that I forgot, Jordan. Thank you for that one.
Yeah.
And some people have, you know, objected to that one because it sounds like storming the Bastille, like it's a liberation struggle rather than something else.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, I'm a military historian for, so storming for me simply describes some kind of mass assault, you know, whether it's whatever the objective is. I mean, I really object to coup. If you want to see a real coup, go watch the movie Valkyrie, which took years of planning and the coordination of multiple different branches of the German government and the German military, you know, and failed despite that coordination and despite the very, very careful planning. A riot is even where there are ringleaders, right? And clearly there were people who led the way on this thing. A riot is largely undirected, uncontrolled, just rampaging and destruction. And I think that's actually the most dangerous thing about a riot is, you know, there's studies about this, but there is a significant subset of the population that is, you know, what's that phrase from? There's this famous quotation about the guys who participated in the Texas Revolution in the 1830s. Like, some of them were for independence, some of them were for joining the United States, and some of them were up for a fight, no matter what it was about. there's just a large group of people who are always going to be up for destruction, you know, just like there were in all of the various kinds of riots and protests last year. Insurrection is, to me, just an attempt to say coup, but sound like you vaguely know what you're talking about, legally speaking. So I, you know, long story short, I have gone with and used riot consistently ever since it happened, because I think that most aptly describes what happened, at least for the vast majority of the people involved in it. As for people who apparently, you know, a small number of people who apparently showed up with some kind of objective to go personally confront Mike Pence or whatever, you know, I've not done a deep dive into the evidence regarding that. Obviously, it would be something else for those people. But even then, I don't know that coup is the right word. I mean, they're the ones that I've read about were apparently planning to somehow intimidate somebody like Mike Pence into doing, you know, this, you know, lost in the shuffle and all this is this weird cockamamie, the idea they had about this kind of last ditch moment where the vice president could override the electoral college or whatever. Apparently there was, you know, for a small number of people, intimidation involved, but riot's the word I go with.
Can I throw a historical note in on that, Jordan?
Yeah.
So the last time someone tried to interrupt a vice president's counting the electoral college ballots, that I'm aware of anyway, was in 2016, when one of the representatives stood up and objected and got gaveled down by the vice president and told she was out of order, and basically said, knock it off or I'll have you removed.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So that vice president being Joe Biden.
Fascinating.
Nice.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Jordan.
No. I mean, I'm kind of rambling. I'm just trying to say I think it was a riot. I think that's the word that best characterizes what happened, particularly because the moment you start to get into using language like coup, you are starting to, with one word, construct the kinds of narratives and, you know, theories of mass coordination, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that is coming through in this piece by Gilman for The Atlantic. Coyle, how about you?
Yeah.
And if I can ask you, do you know, I know the only crime specifically defined in the Constitution is what constitutes treason in a country with no king to betray.
Right.
Do you know anything about constitutionally or legally how insurrection is properly defined?
Yeah, I was looking at that. And I'm not an expert on this. I think the US code just says that insurrection is insurrection. So it kind of kicks that over, I assume, to the jury, but don't hold me to that. I'm not entirely
sure. It's kind of like pornography that way. I know it when I see it.
That's exactly what I was about to say. John Brown attempted an insurrection. Nat Turner led an actual insurrection. But I still think what's going on at the Capitol is a riot.
Well, I think there's I'd add one. I push back a little bit on one thing you said, Jordan, that there was no mass organization there, which, yeah, I think I agree with that. And we should talk about that in a minute. But a coup or an insurrection, whichever of those, doesn't necessarily require mass organization. A few people organizing in a crowd and stirring up a crowd could do something like that. Now, whether or not that's what this was, that's a different question. But
yeah, that's a fair point. And there are, you know, there are historical coups. I mean, we did that whole series on Rome.
Right.
There are some coups that kind of begin by accident, where the, you know, German bodyguards of the emperor have just finally had enough and kill him and grab a guy and make him emperor.
Right.
But of course, we don't have a system that would allow for something like that to happen.
Right. Yeah. So as for what was January 6th, I mean, a bunch of idiots who should have been tear gassed long before they got to the steps of the Capitol building, as far as I'm concerned. Once things go beyond that, I think that's where it requires something that basically the American people aren't capable of. That is, we have to have a nuanced and carefully thought out discrimination between the various people involved. Because like you pointed out, there were people there who were intending to do damage and harm. I don't think there's any doubt about that. There were people there who did batter down the doors of the Capitol building, who did assault police officers, who did break into the House and Senate chambers with the intentions of doing something illegal, whether it was out and out murder of a government official or just intimidation, you know, air quotes, just intimidation or whatever, right? They were there for criminal purposes. And then there were people who were following along behind them, who were more or less helping them. And then there were people who were just walking through the building. And I think all of those different sets of people require different moral and legal responses. Some of those people need sort of the full weight of the law dropped on them. Some of those people need, you know, significantly less of a penalty attached. I also know someone who was there, and I would say that the person I know who was involved probably didn't go there intending to do anything other than protest, did not go to the Capitol building intending to terrify or terrorize or assault anyone. So I would say the punishment that he deserves is probably way farther down on the spectrum than anything else. So riot, yes, but even that, I would say, is too big of a word for many of the people who are there. But, you know, what riot isn't that true of?
Yeah. Thank you for going there, because I think that's true of most things that I would call a riot. Right. And I really do think, and it's funny, I came into this thinking, okay, I'm recording with Coyle and Jordan. I'm going to be the lefty on this podcast, but I'm hearing myself sound old and grumpy and reactionary here. But I mean, I really do think a large part of the desperate scrambling for vocabulary here
is that, you know, whatever happened on January 6th happened on the tail end of 7 months of people posting that, you know, that line from Martin Luther King Jr. that, you know, riots are the voice of the unheard. And right. So they couldn't call this that.
Did that answer your question, Nathan?
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, you know, it's really been something where I'm not sure that I have the right answer by calling it a riot, but I mean, just kind of my, you know, I mean, as someone who teaches writing, I mean, you know, if I were going to, you know, coach someone through a series of drafts on this and they were referring to it as a coup attempt, you know, what I would want to say is, okay, I mean, where did they seize control of military units? Where did they seize modes of mass communication? I mean, there are, you know, sort of standard elements to a modern coup. And incidentally, I mean, one happened not long after this, you know, in Myanmar that actually did unfold like a coup. And, you know, as far as I know, I mean, the previous president of Myanmar is currently in prison at the end of that, you know, where, you know, Mike Pence, as far as I know, has returned to Indiana, is probably making six figures for making speeches at events. So, I mean, you know, what strikes me is that, you know, again, I mean, I think that the rhetoric of social media kind of swallowed its own tail here. And, you know, they couldn't call it what it pretty self-evidently was, because they had just spent several months arguing that, you know, riots are not bad things. It's only the causes behind the riots that are either good or bad.
I think that's exactly right. And that's where you also get this weird pivot. So another behind the curtain peek. When we were, I think before we were recording, I was complaining about how much I hate sanctimony. That's where you get this, you know, what you're describing, Nathan, is where we get this weird pivot to, you know, all this temple of democracy talk. Like, you know, it's the January 6th rioters, to take it back to ancient Rome again. Suddenly they're Catiline infiltrating a women's only sacrifice dressed as a woman. Like, you know, like there's something actually religious about the Capitol building that has been profaned, which I find either unspeakably phony or idolatrous. and I object to both of those things.
And I'll confess that back in January, I was rather enjoying that. I've largely gotten off of social media over the course of the last 6 months, just for my own health. But I was having fun. I mean, letting my Hauerwas flag fly during January 2021, because, oh man, I mean, the number of, you know, progressives and liberals, you know, worshiping the American flag as a religious symbol was just delicious for me.
Right. Well, anything else you want to ask on that, Nathan? Otherwise we should move on.
No, we can move on to other things. Cause like I said, I mean, you know, that was, you know, one of the things that, you know, really isn't central to the argument, but it's certainly part of the rhetoric of this piece, right? I mean, you know, it is, what do we call what happened? And then, you know, the rhetorical escalation technique of calling these people, calling the American right desperate, right? You know, those were two, you know, salient rhetorical features that I wanted to sit on. I mean, Coyle, I mean, what features of this article do you want to expound on for a bit?
I mean, certainly the bit about desperation, I think that's one of the most accurate parts of the article. Because the right does use that language of desperation. And
that's the whole Flight 93 rhetoric from 5 years ago.
Well, or daily talk radio rhetoric, or
yeah,
I mean, and I'm guilty, if guilty is the right word, of using that too. Not because I am personally feeling desperate right now, but because when I look at certainly the cultural landscape, if not always the political landscape, I don't see a place where the right wing of American life has much of a voice. Politically, obviously, I think that's less true. But in cultural, social terms, the right's capital is exceptionally low at this point.
Can I press you on that a little bit, Coyle?
Because yeah, sure.
The way that I see it, and you know, if I'm seeing it wrong, I want you to teach me to see it right, is not that the culture has taken a leftward turn, but that there isn't really a culture anymore, that, you know, what fragmentation there was 30 years ago has accelerated so that now you have subcultures rather than a single pop culture. Does that make sense? So, I mean, you know, what strikes me is that I know people personally who live in a world where they never actually talk to someone who would call themselves progressive. And I know people who live in a world where they never talk to anyone who even, you know, could look at Trump without spitting, much less vote for him. And so, I mean, you know, within those worlds, what I see is both of them see themselves as imperiled, but they're imperiled not by human beings, but by this, you know, insidious force. Does that make sense?
So I think you're right. And we're straying from the article, but this is my fault. So, you're right about the sort of polarization, balkanization of America into these different camps. And I think there's truth to what you're saying about the pop culture, right? Our pop culture is also fragmented. But as far as I'm aware, what pop culture there is only being made for one of those polarized, balkanized segments of society, aside from the little vanity projects, things like Pure Flix or whatever, that are cranking out movies for conservative Christians. There are exceptions like that. But when you look at the quality stuff that Hollywood makes, or the books that major publishers are putting out, they're not putting out things with me in view as a target audience. And hey, I mean, that's fine. It's free market. It's not like the government's making them do that. But again, as a conservative, I actually noticed this the other day. I was thumbing through some academic catalogs, and the conservatives who have always been publishing in them are still publishing in them. That's still the case. But I didn't see any conservative author who was, I didn't check the ages specifically, but under the age of 45 or 50 in mainstream public publishing catalogs, academic publishing catalogs. Is that answering your question, Nathan?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what might be happening is that I don't have any tools for gauging how influential entities like PureFlix or Intercollegiate Studies Institute or the Acton Institute. I mean, it might just be a function of my media diet. But it strikes me that there is an entire ecosystem there of conservative media that, sure, you know, not only could you live there, but I know people who live there. And therefore, I mean, you know, for them, not only is pop culture conservative leaning, but also intellectual culture is conservative leaning.
So certainly things like Acton and ISI hold conferences and put on events. I'm involved in both of those. And at, you know, the Acton conference, I think there were like 800 faculty members there in the pre-COVID era. But again, how much of that? So yeah, those 800 faculty members go back to their private religious colleges and teach, you know, a classroom with 5 to 10 students in it, as compared to, say, what's going on in the rest of the academy, where the other, I don't know how many college students there are at any given point, you know, 5 to 10 million college students are being taught.
All right. Fair enough. Anyway, I'll let you go back to the article. Sorry. I just, like I said, I mean, that's another question that I sometimes roll around in my mind, but I've not talked about it with other human beings. So I wanted to avail myself.
Yeah. So I don't deny that these subcultures exist, but I think they are pretty clearly subcultures. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Fair a word enough. I've heard about conservative media a number of times is ghetto. Because kind of ghettoization of conservatives, where they have their own entirely, you know, compare it to like the Christian music scene or the Christian movie scene or something like that, where, yeah, there's a large, relatively large thriving subculture, but nobody from outside the subculture interacts with that subculture.
Okay, fair enough. And I guess, and I can't remember who the author was or even what the title of the article was, but that article about the exhausted middle is, I think, what's coming to mind here. And I guess I'm thinking of the sort of progressive pop culture ecosystem as its own kind of subculture. And I might be underestimating them and overestimating what's going on the conservative side.
Well, there's certainly a progressive subculture too, although I don't move in those circles, so I don't know as much about it. But my point was more that the broader, you know, mainstream culture, even as fragmented as it is, falls more on the progressive side than on the conservative side, if it falls on the conservative side at all, outside of maybe some libertarian economic views.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. And I, and it might just be that my television diet is largely limited to visiting my in-laws where they watch, you know, CBS cop shows, which tend not to be conservative in their politics. Or no, tend not to be progressive in their politics. I blew that line.
Well, back into the article, and I'm actually going off some of your questions that you've got here. You raised the question of democracy, right? Abstract notions of democracy and threats to the Constitution. And then the author ties that into questions of state voting laws. Because they focus on Georgia, Nathan, did you want to speak to what's going on in Georgia?
Yeah, I and I'll confess that, you know, my sin here was that I actually read the text of the Georgia law before I started reading articles about it. So once I had read what was actually in that law, I didn't recognize what I was seeing in these articles that said that they were, you know, suppressing this and they were, you know, throwing down that and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, what I saw in the actual text of the law is that, first of all, you know, the drop boxes that were introduced as an emergency COVID measure are now codified. They are part of Georgia elections going forward until somebody repeals that law, presumably. Number two, I mean, there's just a repeated emphasis on something that I thought was just a given, that lobbying groups were not allowed inside the polling place. And, you know, beyond that, I mean, you know, it seemed like, you know, largely just kind of restating in fairly clear terms what was already on the books. So, I mean, you know, when Major League Baseball, you know, moved the All-Star game to a state where, you know, COVID drop boxes weren't part of state law, that kind of confused me. And, you know, when, you know, this was, again, back when I was still on social media, when people were calling this, you know, including Joe Biden, were calling this, you know, Jim Crow in the 21st century, you know, my thought was, I mean, Jim Crow didn't put extra voting receptacles in minority districts. I mean, that, like, I'm not an American historian, but I'm pretty sure that's not what Jim Crow did. So, I mean, it's fascinating to me that, you know, I mean, that this is another one of those cases. And again, I never set out, you know, trying to be the conservative in any room. But I kind of become one on this question, and then on the question of the of Indiana's, you know, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you know, on the RFRA, I thought, okay, you know, Indiana is reiterating that Bill Clinton was right, and all of a sudden that makes them Nazis. And, you know, here Georgia is, you know, saying from here on out, we're always going to have COVID ballot drop boxes. And that gets called Jim Crow. And I'll confess, I mean, just because I am more inclined to attribute incompetence to people than malice, I chalk this up to just bad reading comprehension or just didn't read for class and people aren't actually looking at the law. But I mean, you know, Coyle, I mean, you teach political science, and I know you're going to say I'm not an expert in this because that's what you say on podcasts. But I mean, this Georgia law, I mean, does it materially do any of the things that the exorcists want to exercise?
I'm an expert in everything, Nathan. Come on. So I have read a little. I have not read the whole Georgia law because every law is, you know, however many hundreds of pages long.
I should say I read the executive summary, which is about 3 pages long.
Oh, yeah, sure. My understanding, and you're right, this is not my area of political science. My understanding, though, is that this is basically Georgia saying we want to be a little bit more like New York, right? This law is less restrictive than several blue states, not all of them, but several blue states. But it is more restrictive than what they had in place before the law passed. My understanding, and I should have done more reading in preparation for this because it's been a couple of months, but my understanding is that this law, the things that people are upset about are on the front end of voter registration. It's slightly more difficult to register to vote. And I don't remember specifically what those changes are. I think they have to do with what kinds of ID you have to show in order to get your voter registration card.
Yeah, I do remember that. I do remember that.
And then the no interest groups, no lobbying at the polling place. That's actually a fairly standard law, not just in Georgia, but everywhere. But one of the incidents that this involved during the election was an interest group, I think, was trying to hand out bottled water. And again, my memory is a little bit fuzzy here.
Yeah. Have you seen the video of them holding out water, handing out water?
No.
They are handing it out from a table with a big banner of their lobbying group above it.
Right.
Like 12 feet from the voting machines.
Right. So that,
which I looked at that and I said, okay, I mean, that really isn't that difficult. That's a violation of election law.
Right. And again, it's not that they can't give out water at all. At least I don't know Georgia. In Missouri, you're not allowed to do that within 50 feet of the door of the polling place. So
yeah, I think that's roughly what Georgia's is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, they could take a tape measure, go 51 feet away and give water to whoever they want. Now the people are not allowed to carry the water bottles into that radius, but if they're thirsty, they can drink it and then go and vote. Or what they're also allowed to do, what the interest group is also allowed to do, if they're really concerned about getting water to people, they can give the water to the poll workers. And as long as there's nothing on it that says vote for whoever, the poll workers can hand them out. What then people run into as well is the state. And I think this is probably the real objection that no one ever gets to because it doesn't get as many clicks. Is the state providing enough polling workers? Are there enough voting places in urban centers? Are there vehicles to help people register to vote if they're missing the proper paperwork? Those are the sorts of things that are actual objections, but that doesn't sound as good in the tweet as Republicans are denying water to thirsty people trying to vote.
Right, right. And, you know, once again, you know, in this piece, you know, Joe Stevens, that is the author, right? I know we've ventured so far from the article at this point, and that's my fault.
It is.
But yeah, I mean, author. What now?
Barton Gellman is what my mind says.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the author, cause that's not what I saw when I looked at it. So I must've written down a photographer's name or something, but what the article, you know, does is work this into this concerted, again, I'm going to call it conspiratorial effort to make sure that the outcome of every federal election is decided before anyone shows up at the polls. So once again, I mean, you know, one of the difficulties that he has is that, you know, we, the American public, have audio footage of, you know, Raffensperger, at the time, Secretary of State in Georgia. He's actually, you know, I'm going to vote in a Republican primary for the second time in my life this coming year so that Jody Heiss does not replace him. You know, Donald Trump said, you need to find these votes. And, you know, Raffensperger said, we already conducted our election. The election's over. I mean, you know, these are the numbers. And, you know, that datum is something that, you know, I mean, this kind of thinking has trouble dealing with because it introduces the possibility that, you know, the actual rules of conducting elections might be more important to the big time players in this conspiracy than fixing the results.
Yeah, I will slightly defend Gellman's point there, because yes, I think that Republicans are trying to rig the election, and rig the election makes it sound like they're stuffing ballots into boxes. I don't mean that, but I think they are trying to set the rules of election such that it is more likely that they win in 2024. And I think that because that's what political parties in positions of power in states do. That's what they do when they gerrymander. That's what they do when they set up the broad structures of elections. And to say that Republicans are doing that isn't to say Democrats aren't doing that. Democrats have already done that in states that Democrats control. Republicans have already done that in states that Republicans control. They're just tightening the screws on that a little bit in some of these states that were very close that they control in 2020. That's kind of normal state level politics with regard to elections. That's not to say that there's nothing concerning about that it's normal. And again, that's not the same thing as saying this is corruption, right? This isn't stuffing votes into ballot boxes. This isn't I don't know, whatever the conspiracy theories were saying, right? Breaking into the machines and changing, hacking the voting machines and changing the numbers. Nothing like that. It's sort of normal political procedure.
So I guess here's my question, guys. And I mean, Coyle, I'll hear from you first. And then, you know, I want to hear from Jordan too. But I mean, it seems like the author here, and I wrote down the name wrong, so I'll let Coyle say who the author is again. It seems like this is a call to action of some kind. I mean, did you get any sense of what kind of action this article is calling for?
Specifically at the end, he mentions the, what were the name of the acts? The because I'm an old man, I printed this out. The Joe Lewis Voting Rights Act and the For the People Act. I also printed it out because it goes behind a paywall on the Atlantic if you don't get it right away. The For the People Act and the John Lewis, not Joe Lewis, legislator, not boxer, right? Which basically have not passed and probably will never pass. He talked about filibuster reform. He talked about, what else did he mention? Accountability for people involved, not just actually pounding down the doors of the Capitol, but the higher ups who are instigating them, which I have thoughts about that too. But so basically he does make some suggestions, none of which would have accomplished any of the things that he wants them to accomplish. So the For the People Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, again, it's been a while since I've looked at the details of those because they're basically dead, so they don't matter now. Both of them, from what I vaguely remember, would have given the federal government more authority and control over elections. The problem is, if the federal government had more authority and control over elections in 2020, that would have meant Donald Trump would have had more say in the outcome of elections. And,
right.
You know, I can't imagine anyone saying that would have made the election better unless you're already in the tank on the Trump side of things.
Fair enough. Jordan, I want to ask you this question because, again, guys, I mean, I'm sorry I turned this into my own private therapy session, but you guys are here and I'm going to keep doing this. But that's another one of those things that, I mean, I remember starting to think back in the George W. Bush days and all the way through the Obama administration and certainly through the Trump years, is it just strikes me that whoever has the White House at any given moment never really thinks, hey, what if the other party wins another election? Right. Like they just want to like accelerate the ability to do stuff from the Oval Office, you know, with the assumption that, you know, okay, we're always going to have the White House, so it doesn't matter. I mean, am right. I the only one who sees this, or like now I feel like I'm in front of the conspiracy pin board?
No, that's not a conspiracy. I feel like that's readily apparent. I mean, there were the stories about Obama's administration destroying all sorts of documentation ahead of Trump moving into the White House. You know, look, I don't want to mention anything specific because I might have misremembered some of these things over the course of the years. But you know, kind of off the books, sort of executive programs, especially related to the military, that they ran as if they assumed they would always be the people running them. And then when somebody they didn't like won an election, they suddenly had to try to undo these, you know, various intelligence. And I think some of it had to do with drone capabilities and drone strikes, undo all of these pieces of apparatus so that somebody they didn't like could not take advantage of them the way they had. And, you know, yeah, it's for me, but not for thee, for years and years.
And again, I think there is something to some of that also. So you're certainly right that is always in view. Like we will just always have this office. But there's also some using of the office to try to make sure that happens.
Right.
I just finished reading nominally for a Profiles interview, although I don't think I have it in me to do it. Molly Hemingway, the editor of The Federalist, just came out with a book that was, I forget what it's called. It's Rigged or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's just Rigged.
And it's basically the best book you're going to get, I think, in defense of the Trumpian view of the 2020 election, in that she never comes out and says Donald Trump actually won those swing states. She never does that, and never really wanders into conspiracy theories. But one of the things that she does talk about, which I was completely unaware of, apparently in the lead up to 2020, Trump went through state political party rules, and his campaign, I don't mean him personally, but like people working for his campaign, basically changed the rules of the Republican primary process so that there could be no real challengers to him. Which I was unaware of that. And she uses it as a, oh, look at how smart and strategic and all of that he is. And I'm like, well, that sounds really terrible.
She was presenting that as a good thing.
Oh yeah. 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 This is like, oh, look at the unity she's bringing to the, he's bringing to the Republican Party.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I'm like, man, this is really terrible. Like look at the havoc this guy is wreaking on the Republican Party. And of course he's trying to, of course he would like to see this done with the general election too. Now that doesn't, again, that doesn't translate into therefore a nefarious conspiracy to whatever. But it was kind of like, oh, well, that did not sound the way you wanted it to sound.
No.
Yeah. Put that in the do you hear yourself category along with this Gelman piece.
Yeah.
I mean, Jordan, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because I, like I said, of the trio here, I am probably the most routinely and pervasively suspicious of the GOP. And I found this article insufferable. I mean, is there anything in here that's going to convince someone who's not already convinced?
No, absolutely not. And I gave up on the Republican Party a while ago when I realized they'd been using abortion to get my vote for a long time and not really doing much about it. Credit where credit's due. There's been some movement on that front, but I'm taking that advice to Dante from Paradise to be a party of one from this point forward. But no, I mean, this he's that's where I would say, you know, in response to that question about a call to action, there's some kind of gestures towards, you know, do something at the end. You know, the conclusion of the article is basically don't let them. But that's to me, this took much more the form of a kind of ritual denunciation. This is not really meant to be heard by anybody outside the sanctuary, if that makes sense. Because, you know, I am certainly not a Trumpist. Any chance there was of me kind of going back formally to the Republican Party is long gone in this era, owing to that weird drift over the last 5 years. Nevertheless, you know, there was nothing here for me, even as a critic of Trump. Right? This was like I said, the word I keep coming back to is fevered. You know, fevered, kind of paranoid ritual denunciation. It's just kind of stringing together all of the standard, you know, racist, sexist, anti-gay, Donald Trump go away kind of things, and stretching it out to, you know, stretching it out to 20 or 30,000 words. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and that cheer is now going to be in my head for a week. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I am not on the Trump train. I never was. I am open to hearing about. I'm obviously open to hearing about the ways he has had a nefarious effect on the body politic. I thought this was insufferable.
So what I'm hearing here is that Jordan voted for Hillary.
I'm starting to write in the corpses of long dead politicians on my ballots now.
Yeah.
What I tell my students intentionally to provoke them is that I'm so conservative, I think the American Revolution was a bad idea.
Nice.
They don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. Well, we're I have no idea how long we've been recording, but it has to have been an hour at this point. So we should you guys both have places to be. We should wrap this up. How should we be responding to this article and to the 2020 election. Guys, let's hear on the podcast, solve the problems of the Republic. And I'll, since I'm springing this question on you, I'll go first. I think what we saw in 2020 was, an election that, while there were issues with it, given that it was conducted in a pandemic, and given that it was highly contentious and polarized, and given the sheer number of swing states that sort of caught everyone by surprise, like just as in 2016, the fact that Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania were swing states wasn't really on anyone's radar. That was even more true in 2020 when you throw in Arizona and Georgia and North Carolina and, I mean, again, Nevada, right? So again, given all of those factors, the fact that we had a fairly run election that generally went the way the people voted in those various states, despite the efforts of the person in the most powerful office in the world to undermine or overturn all of those actions, that's a pretty good sign of health of the Republic. And I think if we want the health of the Republic to continue without regard to political party, then investing in the institutions that carried out the 2020 election, those state level and local institutions, that's what we've got to focus on. The attention needs to be placed on strengthening those rather than on shifting all of this up to the federal government where, you know, everything's partisan and polarized. Anyway, that's where I would go. I'm not saying I'm happy about the results of the 2020 election. I think it was kind of a no-win election from my perspective. But in terms of the actual process, I think things worked about as well as they could have been expected to work. And I think taking that good thing and strengthening it is a worthwhile exercise. Jordan, what do you have for us?
There's a lot to think about there. I definitely think it's a fair point that the institutions, some of the institutions and some of the structures of the Republic are doing pretty good. I think it's down to a few people who were virtuous enough, at least in the one regard of taking an unpopular stand and also going against the intense pressure of leadership. You know, people like Raffensperger in Georgia. I mean, that was the one thing that I can't remember if Gelman actually says this in that Atlantic piece, but if he praises anybody on the other side of the aisle, it's Raffensperger, and I would second that, because it's going to take that kind of thing to maintain those institutions. I mean, the founders were very clear that the system itself was not a cure-all, and that it was going to rely on the virtue of the people running it and the virtues of the people electing those people who ran it. And to Nathan's point earlier about us not really having a culture anymore, that is going to create problems for having a body politic that has the virtues to keep institutions strong even when leaders are weak. So I am, no one will be surprised to find that I am pessimistic about this, but I would love to be proven wrong.
All right, Nathan, Jordan thinks the 6 million people who watched the last episode of Game of Thrones with David French won't save us. What do you got?
What I've got is something a lot more house level, and I don't mean House of Representatives. I mean your uncle's house when you visit there for the holidays. And I think that, first of all, you know, I've said a couple times this episode that I've largely phased myself out of social media over the last several months. I strongly recommend that, to the extent that you can, get yourself away from systems that make you think that you're responsible for political forces that are far larger than you and really don't care about your opinion remotely. So on that house level, your uncle's house, what I would prescribe is a kind of ironic naivete. And here's what I mean by that. Whether you are talking to people who are Trumpists, or whether you are talking to people who are part of what I would call the multinational capitalistic liberal class, you know, the people who want, you know, there to be more gay billionaires. Post questions. One of the salient features and one of the central features of the two political factions that we have is that they did not arise out of ideas, and therefore they are largely incoherent. And even if we don't end up, you know, breaking apart enough space for a real third party like the American Solidarity Party to rise up and contend, at the very least, on a spiritual level, I think it is good to relativize these two parties that are not only incoherent, but also have tendencies towards absolutism. They don't just want your vote. They don't even just want your campaign donations. They also want your soul. And, you know, this might be the former preacher coming out in me, but, you know, the contest that I find most interesting here in the Obama-Trump era, because I didn't see as much of this before the Obama election of 2008. I see a lot more of it now, is that, you know, as the local congregation becomes less and less a factor in more people's spirituality, the national parties have kind of taken that place. So whatever you can do, listeners, to unmask those powers, to use a book title from, you know, Walter Wink from the 1980s, do that, because what you do on Facebook isn't going to do a whole lot. What you do on the ballot box is important, but ultimately isn't going to swing a state in most cases. What you do in conversation with your uncle, who is the Trumpist, or your niece, who is the squatter, that really might make a difference.
You're here.
Yeah, I can agree with that too. Well, thank you guys so much for taking time to come on the show. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high